hello to all. This evening we're going to do from Aristotle to Ayn Rand in regard to objectivity. And I gave you last time the effective definition of objectivity that Ayn Rand used. Volitional adherence to reality by following certain rules of method, a method based on facts and appropriate to man's form of cognition. That is not, as I think I said last time, as different from Aristotle as it might sound, because the method that Ayn Rand advocates is Aristotelian logic. Nevertheless, there are some fundamental epistemological discoveries embodied in this formulation which have a great deal of significance. Now, let us see how we can go through the reduction. I gave you some scattered ideas last time, but let's try to go through it a little more systematically. We're going to start with Ayn Rand's definition of objectivity. For short, adherence via a method based on facts and on man's form of cognition. And obviously the first major thing that leaps out of the page that's different from Aristotle is the idea that the method is based on man's form of cognition as well as being based on facts. Aristotle would have not put any such thing in because he didn't believe that man's form of cognition was relevant to defining cognitive norms or principles. He believed that man's consciousness made no contribution to the cognitive process. It was pure receptivity, like an empty mirror in which reality shone. And therefore, for him, objectivity was a plain mirroring. Concepts simply mirrored what was out there, and the only thing that was relevant was that your method be based on facts. Now, for Ayn Rand, it's not enough that your method be based on facts because our consciousness contributes something. Concepts are partly human, and therefore objectivity has to incorporate this element. And therefore, the first obvious reduction, if we're going to get to this definition of objectivity, we have to first reach her distinctive theory of concepts as involving both reality and man's consciousness. We have to find some contribution of man's consciousness in the process of the process of concept formation, and then we'll reach an idea of what a concept is that'll include that, and then that will amend what is objectivity. So the question then becomes, how did Ayn Rand reach her theory of concept formation? What observations about knowledge were necessary to make it possible for her to reach that? Now, there are four that I can identify. I'm not 100% certain of the order, but I think that the most logical order, I think, would be as follows. Going backwards now from in the reduction, we want to get to a theory of concepts that includes the contribution of consciousness, then we're going to have to know in advance that consciousness has a certain identity, that the identity of consciousness is the means to cognition, not the obstacle. That will be essential if we're going to then grasp that a certain type of consciousness grasped in a certain way, and yet that we can have objectivity. So I would say the first crucial thing going backwards is we have to be able to grasp that consciousness has identity. Now, what would that involve in this context? Well, we have to have some idea of what its identity consists of. And we're going to define its identity essentially in terms of its ability to do something with measurements. That's going to be the key to the ability of concepts to transcend percepts. So this is going to require some knowledge of measurement as a means of transcending percepts. And that, I would say, is the next step back down. Now, if you're going to grasp measurements, or the omission of measurements, as a way of dealing with perceptual material, then I think that is going to imply an earlier grasp of integration, because it's a form of integration. And therefore, before you could grasp this specific thing, you'd have to have the concept of putting together parts into a whole. Some general awareness of integration as being important to knowledge in general. And that's another series of observations. And then what would be have to presuppose before you can put together, you have to have taken apart into sequences, into steps. And that would lead you to the earliest observation that knowledge involves some kind of sequences. Some concept formation, for instance, is one step and then the next. Or the development of your concepts, one concept, then the next one is built on it, and so on. So you must have observed, in the earliest terms, some sort of order to your knowledge. So, going now as an agenda, I would put it like this. That is starting now on the inductive direction. Assuming that we have already the knowledge that Aristotle bequeathed, we would reach Ayn Rand's formulation first, making the four elementary observations that I've already mentioned. That is, knowledge has an order, knowledge involves integration, the measurement is a key means of transcending percepts, and then finally the issue of consciousness having identity. On that basis, we are primed. This would be the second, if you think of those four steps as the first elementary steps to prepare the theory of concept formation. On that basis, we reach the theory of concept formation, and we'll see how she did it actually by direct observation, given that cognitive background. And then the last stage will be to integrate the theory of concepts with Aristotle's concept of objectivity and see the amendments that it involves. And those changes, by the way, will include an expansion or a reformulation of what it means to go by logic, as well as an expansion or reformulation of objectivity. That'll be when we build the idea of context and hierarchy into logic, which Aristotle himself had not done, or at least not in the full conscious way. And that will then give us a full idea of what does it mean to correspond or conform to reality by following a certain method, because now we'll spell the method out completely. So that's our assignment for this class. And let's jump right in with the most elementary point, that knowledge follows a definite order. Now, Aristotle knew many aspects of this principle, and he was a necessary precondition of Ayn Rand on this point. For instance, Aristotle knew that in reasoning, we start with observations and then have to arrange our premises step by step into a chain leading ultimately to the conclusion that we want to prove. He also had the idea that we formed successively broader concepts, and that in that sense he had the idea of a hierarchy of concepts, each level resting on the preceding. Unfortunately, his idea of a hierarchy or order was rationalistically skewed in various ways. You'll have to take a course to see how Plato's influence caused him to distort just about every valid observation that he made. But he did have, setting aside that Platonism, a lot of observations about the order of knowledge. Ayn Rand had the advantage here not only of being a total anti-Platonist, but also because of the tremendous amount of knowledge discovered by the 20th century that was unavailable to Aristotle, which made the order of knowledge inescapable to just about anybody. For instance, the history of science, which Aristotle knew nothing about, is a continuous pyramid of discoveries, each stage building on the previous. And there was not nearly as many or as eloquent examples of this fact in Greece. Or again, the necessary order of schooling from kindergarten through PhD in order to impart to children a wealth of knowledge in subjects undreamed of by the ancients. Of course, they had an order of learning in school too, but nothing like the structure that we have. And I think a major factor here is Ayn Rand's lifelong self-awareness or introspective observations, specifically her discovery of how each new idea or item that she grasped opened the path for her to learn the next and then the next. She was very introspective. She could see this pattern on herself, and from all this kind of data about herself and mankind, it was obvious to her as a generalized formulation that we build knowledge on knowledge in a definite order, the earlier each time making the next advance possible. Now you see that this is not a complex observation after, not after Aristotle and the history of science, and to abstract, to reach the principle by induction, especially if you're brilliant, is perfectly straightforward. You don't need a theory of concept formation. On the contrary, you need to grasp this much to even get such an idea. Now, next, to get from order to integration. You can think of it, if you want, that the first point you grasp that knowledge is a series of separate steps. It's like the analysis element, but you have to grasp also the combination element, the synthesis, the putting together, and its importance to cognition. And Ayn Rand had grasped this issue, what she calls integration, inductively very early. Well before the issue of concept formation, she knew that knowledge as such involved integration. Or as she put it in the earlier years, all knowledge is interrelated, and you have to think accordingly. You have to connect every item into a single sum, a whole. Now on this particular issue, Aristotle had a lot of glimmers, but he didn't have the actual correct viewpoint. As a logician, of course, he knew the importance of integrating premises. As a philosopher, he knew the importance of integrating problems and the answers to them into one total system. But he did not have the concept of knowledge as being inherent, as requiring integration as such. For instance, Aristotle believed that every science starts with its own unique axioms, and that it always, therefore, remains a separate, self-contained system, each science, physics, math, whatever it happens to be. So the ultimate integration that Ayn Rand envisages as being necessary at each stage, Aristotle had a kind of methodological, deliberate splintering, that you could get the structure of each subject matter and integrate it, but you could never integrate it into a total. Plus, he agreed with Plato that there is an element of chance in the universe, a chance event being a brute occurrence that can't be integrated into the sum. It's not tied to principles or laws. So he was prohibited by elements in his metaphysics and epistemology. He was a precondition of Ayn Rand on this issue, but he did not have the correct doctrine fully. Now, if we looked at the history of philosophy, the best actual predecessor of Ayn Rand on this would be someone you probably wouldn't have dreamt of, and that would actually have been Hegel, because that was his great virtue, if you could find it in the chaos and mysticism of his writings. But Hegel actually believed that all knowledge is a sum, that every item implies every other, that there is nothing by chance and no inexplicable element, and that integration is the key to knowledge. That really was his whole idea of the coherence theory of truth. Unfortunately, Hegel believed this in a completely mystical, rationalistic way, I don't know whether Ayn Rand in her reading of the history of philosophy got any leads from Hegel or threw all of him out. I incline to believe the latter, judging by such comments as she made about Hegel in my presence. She never said he was a monster, but in any event, it seems to me that a great place for her to have got the data for the conclusion about integration would again be her own mental processes, specifically her own habit of integration, which she practiced at least from the age of 12 as a definite conscious method. Because one of her most distinctive mental traits was her practice of always connecting what for other people are simply isolated elements. She was always seeing relations where no one, including me, suspected them. I was struck by that from the first time I met her. It was like she was standing on this mountaintop and she could see relationships where you would never dream of looking. You know, the standard things that we take for granted now is between connections between sex and economics, or between metaphysics and romantic art. I mean, you can multiply the examples. In the same way, she regularly found contradictions among other people's ideas, when the people themselves didn't even think of bringing those ideas into relation with each other. For example, her youthful criticism of economists for not integrating their free enterprise economics with their Christianity on Sundays, and her lifelong disdain of what she called compartmentalization, which is the refusal to integrate the subject you're specializing into the rest of human knowledge. Or take her disdain from the age of 12 for what she later called concrete-bound mentalities. A concrete-bound mentality is a person who specifically, deliberately does not relate concretes to one another. That's the kind she used to give this example, that after long discussions would see that government regulations don't work in the steel industry or in the timber industry, and then say, but what does this have to do with the coal industry? And she always was astounded, because it was always a rule of her mind to look for connections. And the more she looked, the more she found. And I think this comes back to her commitment to induction. Led her constantly to look for the general principles implicit in concretes, and then for the broader principles uniting earlier principles. And the result was she was always coming up with connections that surprised people. So it was very easy for her to generalize and induce. Knowledge involves integration. In fact, integration was so important to her that it even got a sentence in Galt's speech. I'm referring to the, and you know, there she cut to the bone everything that she didn't think was, she cut everything of epistemology that she didn't think was absolutely indispensable. I'm referring to his reference to the need to integrate an idea without contradiction into the sum of one's knowledge. Now, this was written in the mid-50s, and it, to me, it's very instructive that she felt no need at that point even to hint at the nature of concept formation in Galt's speech. Although she'd known her theory of concept formation for about 10 years by that point, and she certainly had the skill to condense anything into a throwaway half a sentence if she had just wanted to get it out in any way, but she didn't. So she obviously at this point thought integration was absolutely crucial, but she hadn't yet integrated her theory of concept formation into the total fabric of her philosophy. Anyway, at this point she knew that all knowledge is a sum reached by integration, and then if we combine that by spiral with the earlier point, then that sum at each point makes possible the next stage of knowledge. Now let's go on to the issue of mathematics. She needed some knowledge of mathematics before it could occur to her to explain integration, the integration and concept formation, in mathematical terms. At a minimum, she needed the knowledge that she stressed later that measurement requires a unit of measurement, that the unit varies according to the subject matter, and that what measurement does is relate a given entity or attribute to the right unit. Now, obviously, she didn't originate any of this, but this information could be learned by its discoverers initially only through a range and variety of instances of units, foot, pound, second, etc., and then an inductive generalization, that there always has to be a unit, that it varies according to the subject matter and what measurement consists of. Further still, in regard to math, she needed the conclusion, which again she didn't originate, that measurement expands man's range of knowledge beyond the perceptual level. You know, the standard example that you can't grasp the moon's distance by perceptual means, and you can't communicate it to an animal, but you can say it's, what, 240,000 miles, and a mile is 1,760 yards, and a yard is 3 feet, and a foot is this. And by that means, you can grasp the non-perceivable by relating it to the perceivable. And that was obviously a crucial element in her ability to grasp concept formation, the knowledge in advance of what mathematics enabled us to do, and to transcend the perceivable. And then when she grasped that concepts transcend the perceivable, it becomes unavoidable, to her at least, to explain one in terms of the other. Now, the part about mathematics was an easy inductive conclusion, and it was known by people about mathematics for a long time before Ayn Rand. Now, the next point about consciousness has identity. I'm not sure when exactly this point comes up. It's conceivable to me that it might not have been thought of until after the theory of concept formation, but it certainly could have come up before the theory of concepts, and I'm inclined to think it would have. So that's what I'm doing it as now, as in this reconstruction. I'm talking about the point that consciousness has identity. Now, I think a number of people misinterpret this point. The principle that consciousness has identity is not a mere application of A as A to consciousness. It's not a deduction from the law of identity or a mere application of the law of identity. If you just said A is A, therefore consciousness is something, and walked away from it, that would leave the principle that consciousness has identity empty of any real significance. It would be like saying, well, a gremlin is a gremlin, everything is what it is, and that's it. Actually, the principle that consciousness has identity is, are you ready for this, an inductive generalization that you reach by observing consciousness function and seeing that it has to function in certain definite ways, that there are certain things it does recurringly and can't gain any knowledge without doing, such as it has to grasp items in a certain order, such as it has to perform a continuous integration, such as it relates the non-perceivable to the perceivable. In other words, all of our first three principles in this class are instances of consciousness having identity. And if we only had grasped these three, that would be enough to give significant meaning to a generalization. Consciousness has to operate in certain specific ways, as against being a blank mirror or pure receptivity, which is the way Aristotle thought of it. This is why, by the way, when you lay out the axioms of objectivism, you say existence exists, and man is a faculty of consciousness, and A is A, you do not at the beginning say, well, and the fourth one is consciousness has identity, which many people have said, why don't you just interconnect all of the axioms? Why say existence has identity and not consciousness has identity when you're laying out the axioms? Because it doesn't have any content at the stage of the axioms. You have to have a lot of epistemological observations to get to the point of grasping, oh, it has to always function according to this pattern and this pattern and this pattern. There are certain principles governing it. It has to operate a certain way. And now you connect that at that point with A is A, and you have something that you say, a consciousness has identity. Now you illuminated still further the crucial importance of A is A, and in that typical reciprocal fashion, A is A makes your grasp that consciousness operates in certain ways profound and metaphysical. So you can go somewhere with it. So I think it's only after a fairly advanced study of consciousness that she could grasp what seemingly self-evident principle that consciousness has identity. Now, there were other polemical stimuli to this conclusion. You know, for instance, the sophist's standard attack on the senses. If you put a warm hand in tepid water, it feels cool. And a cold hand, it feels warm, and therefore the senses are invalid. And she knew for a long time that means you have to perceive in a certain specific way, therefore your senses are no good. And I think the greatest polemical stimulus was Kant, because his whole critique amounted to you have to think in a certain specific way, therefore your mind is no good. And she had fought all these people for many years, even in college, before the theory of concept formation. So she had ample material, positive and negative, from which to induce the principle that consciousness has identity and that this is crucial. Now, as I say, the content of its identity would be the kind of observations we're making so far here. That the senses function a certain way, that we go in a certain order, that we have to integrate, etc. But once she grasped the theory of concept formation, then the main content of the identity of consciousness became, it's a conceptual mechanism which functions by measurement omission. So at a later stage of knowledge, that gave the essential filling to consciousness has identity. But I think you had to know something about that before you could get there. So I take to summarize now Aristotle's concept of objectivity and the four that we mentioned. Knowledge has a certain order, the crucial importance of integration, something about mathematics and the relation of the non-perceivable to the perceivable, and the issue of the identity of consciousness as the background knowledge that Ayn Rand had to have reached. And all of it is inductive to make it possible for her to go on to discover her theory of concept. Now we go on to the next stage, which is how she actually arrived at the theory of concepts. And here again, it's not a surprise that she did it by introspection, in the sense that there is no way to grasp a cognitive process except by studying it directly. And the one that you have the greatest familiarity with and the total access to, including every relevant conditioning feature, factor, motive, context, etc., is your own. So it's unavoidable that major epistemological discoveries are made by geniuses who look at what they are doing at the functioning of their own mind. Now, I want to read you this story, which she tells at the very end of IOE. And she said, somewhere in the 1940s, I was discussing, I'm quoting, now it's page 307 if you have it, I was discussing the issue of concepts with a Jesuit who philosophically was a Thomist. He was holding to the Aristotelian position that concepts refer to an essence in concretes, And he specifically referred to manness in man and roseness in roses. I was arguing with him that there's no such thing and that these names refer merely to an organization of concretes, that this is our way of organizing concretes. We never really finished the argument. Now, this is what's interesting to me, is that he left at this point, and she says, but after this conversation, I was dissatisfied with my own answer because I felt, yes, I've indicated where concepts come from, but I haven't indicated what is the process by which we organize concretes into different groups, because I certainly don't agree with the modern nominalists who claim that it's an arbitrary convention or an arbitrary grouping. So at that point, I asked myself, what is it that my mind does when I use concepts? To what do I refer and how do I learn new concepts? And within half an hour, I had the answer. I'm astounded at that. Now, she says, it took me longer than that to check it, to apply it to various categories of concepts and see if there are exceptions. But once I had the answer by the logic of it, I knew that that's it, and that's it. Now, who can comment on that? She grasped what her mind was doing on just a few examples. But she didn't consider her definition valid until she methodically tried it out on every kind of concept. That's the issue of range. And here she was deliberately engaging in a process of induction, not just man and rose, and not just nouns, but every kind of concept, action, motion, adverbs, prepositions, adjectives, conjunctions. And I get the historical credit for bringing in materials, because I asked her one day, how would it apply to water? And she paused, and I paused, and she suggested something, and I went home and wrote a paper, and then she went over it in great detail, correcting me and thinking aloud, and then she put one line in the chapter on how it would apply to materials, which was the final legacy of this long paper I wrote on water. And then she, you know, had to apply it to concepts of consciousness, axiomatic concepts, higher level concepts. In fact, the whole IOE is a statement of what she observed in regard to every category of concept on the basis of which she induced the master principle. And the way I put her induction in OPAR was this, that the similar concretes integrated by a concept differ from one another only quantitatively, only in the measurement of their characteristics. Or putting it otherwise, concept formation is a process of retaining the similar characteristics while omitting their measurements. Now, a whole lecture would be required to go through just this one induction and show how she would grasp it in the different forms. And that I'm going to do in the next course following this. But for now, I want you to just see it as part of the total development here. And the relevant point here is that, and she explicitly insisted on this to me, that her theory of concept formation was a purely inductive conclusion. She made no attempt to deduce it from the nature of reason or knowledge or the mind or consciousness or anything else. She simply observed what she did and induced using her knowledge of math to help her identify what she observed. Which I have to say bothered me at the time, because I wanted a deduction for everything. And I was giving her all the standard rationalist stuff about, but why does it have to be that way just because it is that way? Which she finally beat out of me. Now, where did she go? I don't know her order of development from this point, But I know that the, one of the first things that she would have to do is integrate her theory of concepts with her earlier conclusions about knowledge. In other words, spiral back and reformulate her earlier views as necessary. For instance, the principle that knowledge involves a definite order is easy to integrate with the fact that in her theory, concept formation is inherently hierarchical. This earlier, simply observational point that knowledge has a certain order can be seen not just as a as an observation the way Aristotle essentially did, but as an expression or result of the very nature of concepts. So what was first reached by induction becomes a corollary of another induction, and that is a typical process of the growth of knowledge. Or take the issue that integration is essential, that knowledge involves relating elements into a sum. That easily ties into the discovery that a concept itself is a form of relating cognitive items. Or putting it another way, if a concept is our means of integrating data, then our consciousness by its nature is an integrating mechanism. So the conclusion that knowledge is a sum, that at each point makes possible the next item we learn, ties in obviously to the issue that concepts have a certain nature, that they are formed in a context, that they're contextual and hierarchical. In other words, I've skimmed over that pretty fast, but the point here is only the preliminary epistemological observations, the ones which enabled her to go on and reach the theory of concept formation, are now seen to be aspects or expressions of that very theory. And these are good examples of the spiral theory of epistemology. Getting to a higher level and going back and seeing a deeper meaning in what you saw earlier, although the earlier enabled you to get to the later. Now, what did she do with the theory of concept formation once she had it and had integrated it to her earlier knowledge about knowledge? She kept on integrating, expanding the theory as new information about knowledge came in. For example, this is how she discovered the what we call the crow epistemology. That was not part of her original theory in the 40s. I think she discovered that about a decade or so after measurement omission. And it came about that a psychologist she knew told her about an experiment done with crows, a widely known in the field by psychologists, cognitive psychologists, that they could count, in effect, only to three. You know, I assume you know this example from IOE. And then this gentleman made to her a conventional remark, that one that seemed to him safely objectivist, to the effect of how limited crows are compared to human beings, because we can count, you see, to this huge number. And her eyes lit up, and she said, "No, the exact opposite is true. It doesn't put crows in a bad light at all, because she made a sudden connection, a new integration, instantaneously. Not how different crows are from us, but how similar, in that both species have a very limited mental screen." And she saw the point at once that this is why where concepts save the day for us. As against the crows, we're both limited in the number of units we can contemplate or retain. She had already understood concepts as integrators of an unlimited number of percepts into a single mental unit. Well, if you combine that with the idea of the crow of our screen being limited, and this actually follows by deduction, it led to the conclusion that concepts economize units, that they're mental space savers, which enable us continually to expand the amount of material we can hold at any one time in our minds. In other words, enable us to deal with an ever-growing range of knowledge, as against animals who are limited to a handful of concretes, because anything more overloads them and they go blank, as the crows did. Now, I'll give you a little touch here. I think I can get this in. It was just helpful to see if you have any trace of rationalism. In my very first, she had presented this whole thing to me before it appeared in print. I was out in Denver at the time, and she was giving me these private sessions on epistemology to prepare me to lecture on this out there. And in my very first course in the 60s, I deliberately reversed her order of presentation on this issue, because I thought I have a much neater organization. My first class was on the crow epistemology, which you could teach, you know, by itself. Our mental space is limited and so on. The need to save mental space. And then I built up step by step to the nature of a concept as that which enables us to satisfy this need. And that gave me the feeling, you see, that I could deduce concept formation and measurement omission from our need for extra mental space. So I could say QED. Now it's perfectly logical. See, we've got this requirement, and it's just like so-and-so. It's just like as if I start with hunger and therefore food. And I mentioned that to Arne, that I thought that was an improved organization, and you could project her reaction to that. Her immediate reaction was no, she said. That was a very valuable lesson. She said, first you look at what something is and then what its results are. Whereas you, she said to me, you start with what it has to be or has to do by the fact that you arbitrarily decide that's the crucial point, and then you infer, what must it be to live up to this demand. And that, of course, is a perfect statement of the difference between induction and rationalistic deduction. I wanted the system where there was no escape. And she didn't want to construct inescapable systems. She wanted to start with facts. And then if it followed that those facts performed a certain function, good. And if not, too bad. But there was no attempt at a polemical structure of deduction that was impregnable. I put that in for what it's worth, because that is a sign of rationalism that might not have been obvious, but it was very helpful to me to grasp. Or now we're ready to do the final cashing in. She's reached her theory of concepts. How does it lead her to a reformulation of the concept of objectivity? Now we have not a new induction here, but a restatement of her conclusions so far, in order to answer the perennial question in the history of philosophy, namely, what is the relationship of concepts to reality? Now, I assume you know that traditionally there were two answers. There are all kinds of subdivisions, but two broad schools. The realists, who said that concepts are a grasp of special external non-material objects, such as universals or essences, and that in one way or another was Plato and Aristotle and their followers. As against nominalists, from the Latin nomen for name, and this was the theory that concepts are simply words, they're names that we arbitrarily use according to our convenience. We decide to group vaguely similar concretes by whim, according to our convenience, and call them by a certain name. So concepts are arbitrary subjective devices. Now, she had rejected both of these theories from college days on, because the one made knowledge mystical. It was a grasp of some external, non-material, non-perceivable object. And the other made knowledge arbitrary. In other words, it led to subjectivism and skepticism. But given her theory, she knew now that there were two things true about the relation between concepts and reality. One, they are based on observation of reality. They're not arbitrary. And here the fact was, you have to go through a precise mathematical process based on actual observed similarities to reach them. But the other thing, too, she knew that in some sense concepts are human. In other words, they're reached by the method of measurement omission. And this method, as far as we know, all we can say is that's the way the human mind or brain is built. We have no knowledge on the question of how other consciousnesses in the universe, if there are any, such as Martians or extraterrestrials or whatever, we don't know how their consciousnesses operate. So all we can say about measurement omission is that's what we do in order to relate the non-perceivable to what we perceive. So to that extent, it is a contribution by our structure of cognition. Also, we know that concepts are human in the sense that they fulfill one of our requirements, one of our needs, namely extra space, in effect. We don't know the needs of alien consciousnesses, if any, or how they deal with a multiplicity of data. So the summary, the way I summarize this is, concepts are a device of our consciousness to deal with existence. They don't pertain to consciousness alone, which is what the nominalist said. They don't pertain to existence alone, which is what the realist said. They are products of a specific kind of relationship between the two. Now, without the right preparation for this theory, she could conceivably, Ayn Rand, have been led to feel that she has to apologize for the fact that concepts have a human dimension, or minimize it in some way, lest she say, oh, that's going to lead to subjectivism, we don't perceive reality as it really is, Kantianism, etc. On the contrary, she seized on that and insisted that concepts have a human dimension, and insisted that it was only because of this fact that they could give us a grasp of reality. Now, what is the principle that she was counting on here so that she could go so confidently from her theory of concepts to the affirmation of the fact that preserves knowledge and the possibility of knowledge? Obviously, she's counting on the idea that consciousness has identity. That it's only because our mind has an identity, because there's something, that we can acquire knowledge at all. If our consciousness was zero, as the Greeks had held, if it added nothing to the process of cognition, it was just an emptiness on which reality writes, well, then what would reality be writing on? Or how would facts ever get through and make contact on us, with us? If consciousness was this kind of zero, it wouldn't exist. There'd be no knowledge. Now, the Greek fear was, well, but if it's something, if it makes a contribution, if it adds to the cognitive process, then won't that be a distortion? Which is just what Kant and the nominalists all said in different ways. And her answer was, there's no problem of distortion, because whatever the varying forms or methods of consciousness are, they're all forms or methods of grasping something. In other words, of grasping reality. There's nothing else to grasp or to be conscious of. And that is the principle that consciousness has identity, but it has to grasp what's there somehow, by some means, according to its nature, according to the processes that it performs. So to object to the fact that there's a human element in concept formation is really to object to A. In other words, once she grasped the contribution of consciousness in concept formation, she integrated that with the principle that consciousness has identity. She simply distinguished the form from the object of cognition, and there was no problem. And as far as people who said, well, concepts are invalid because they involve a, quote, human side, she no longer had any patience with them now, because she saw that as an attack on the law of identity within the realm of consciousness. So she insists that conceptualization involves consciousness and existence, and she throws it in the face of preceding philosophers. Identity, she says, is the means of knowledge, not the obstacle to it. Now you see why that is going to be so crucial for objectivity. Because if objectivity is just a method based on facts, and it has to be this kind of luminous mirror correspondence, then anybody can point out our conscience is not nothing. It does function a certain way. We can only perceive things as human beings perceive them, and we can only conceive as human beings conceive them. So there is no objectivity. That's the standard argument based on the Aristotelian concept of objectivity, which is simply that reality alone can contribute to a grasp if it's to be objective. It's adherence to reality by a certain method, and the method has no requirement but that it be facts of reality. If you had said to Aristotle, well, but the method is also going to be based on human nature or the human mind, he'd say, well, then you're destroying objectivity. He has a specific passage that consciousness must not have an identity if it's to be able to grasp reality. So this is obviously essential to grasp the right concept of objectivity. She had to grasp the right concept of concept formation combined with the issue that consciousness has identity. And that would then lead her to reformulate that it's not only correspondence deliberately or volitionally by the use of a method, but that the method has to be based on facts and on our means of knowing facts. Now notice that I don't hesitate to call measurement omission a method, even though it's something done automatically by our conceptual faculty and does not involve our choice or our supervision or even our knowledge of it. People have been omitting measurements for thousands of years without identifying that fact. So method is obviously a much broader term than logic. It subsumes logic as a conscious content. But method really covers whatever process we engage in that's divisible into steps that we can follow, whether consciously or otherwise. And of course it applies to organized steps or successive steps leading to any result. It's not restricted to epistemology. There's a method of dieting, a method of shooting, etc. So when we get to the final, I think you now see the whole implication of the final objectivist definition of objective. It's adherence to reality following certain rules of method, a method based on facts and appropriate to man's form of cognition. So method in conscious terms still means logic. In that sense, Aristotle was 100% right. But she uses the broader term, rather than simply saying by the method of logic, in order to cover the whole fact of the conceptual level, including both our conscious method, And the subconscious aspect, the subconscious element of what our conscious does, namely omit measurements. And I think that gives you the whole picture of her, how she reached her reformulation. So that's not actually too hard, right? Seems pretty clear to me. Now, I'll just say a word on the cash value or significance of her reformulation of objectivity. I think it's pretty clear. It enables us to identify the exact relation of concepts to reality and how they're based on reality, and therefore validates concepts, and therefore all conceptual knowledge, which previous theories couldn't do. And this is what's even important to specifically grasping objectivity. It enables us to construe logic, which is the conscious method, much more fully than Aristotle could. He defined the idea of logic. But when we say now, against the background of the objectivist theory of concepts, that the way to be objective is the use of logic, we said with a much fuller understanding of what logic, even on the conscious level, has to include. Because we know that the very thing which underlies the need of logic, a conceptual consciousness, also demands hierarchy and context. Yeah, that's inherent in concepts as part of her theory, if you know the theory of concepts. Concepts are formed in a context and are formed hierarchically. So we know that since those two features, context and hierarchy, are built into the nature of concepts, nothing can qualify as logic which drops either of them. So when Aristotle said, don't commit any contradictions, Ayn Rand said, yes, and the way to know whether you're doing that or not is to retain the full context and hierarchy in connection with every use of the laws of logic. And that gives you a method of validating conclusions that was simply not available earlier. In other words, if Aristotle said, don't be contradictory, people couldn't identify what is non-contradictory identification until they learn that this has to take account of and tie to the total body of knowledge, as against merely an isolated fragment. That's the context issue. And that it has to involve the reduction not only of propositions, but also of each concept, back to sensory data through all the levels that are required. That's the hierarchical issue. So if you are really to say this conclusion is objective, you have to, one, validate each concept by showing how it would be reduced back to perceptual data, and then show that the proposition is reducible back and integratable with the sum total of the rest you know. Now, that's what she built into logic as a corollary of simply applying to the process that Aristotle had put forth, logic, what she now knew about objectivity, thanks to her theory of concept formation. Now this, of course, is a major, major discovery, because the way I put it in OPAR, It not only enables us to base conclusions on reality, but to do it consciously and methodically, to know that we're doing it and by what means. In other words, to be in control of the process of cognition. And this is, if anything qualifies as a landmark discovery, this is one of them. Now, we got to have a contrast here for a clear grasp of her theory. And of course, the contrast is here to the two schools that are opposite to her on this issue. Before her, there was only the objective versus the subjective. But it's very misleading to lump all wrong philosophies together on this issue as subjective. In a sense, you can say it's true. If you're not objective, you're subjective. Because even Plato and people like him base their super dimensions ultimately on a desire or a feeling. But even though you could argue, well, everything is either objective or subjective, if you're trying to identify wrong philosophies, it's a mistake to lump all wrong philosophies together, because there are major differences in the kind of error between Plato or the religious school who claim objectivity and want or say they want a base in reality versus the avowedly, proudly subjectivist school. And this is thus we have since Ayn Rand a trichotomy. We have the three schools, the objectivist, the intrinsicist, and the subjectivist. Now, I assume you know the two false schools you can read up in my book, and of course, intrinsicism is related to mysticism, and subjectivism to skepticism. In fact, intrinsicism and subjectivism are the more fundamental terms that lead to mysticism and skepticism. If you believe that the essence of knowledge is to grasp, on the conceptual level, is to grasp some non-material, external, intrinsic factor, then the only way to grasp it is going to be a la Plato, and that means your theory of knowledge is going to be mysticism. If you believe there's nothing out there that corresponds to your concept, then you're going to say that's a subjectivist view. Well, then the concepts are not means of knowledge of reality, so you're going to be led to skepticism. So mysticism and skepticism are like the epistemological results of intrinsicism and subjectivism in the theory of concept formation. Now, the epistemological result of the objectivist approach is, of course, reason is your means of knowledge, not mysticism and not skepticism. Knowledge is possible, but only by observation and then concept formation, which follows objective rules. Now, I want to save some time. I've got a number of written questions and hopefully take a few oral ones, but I want to make a comment again in regard to Aristotle. I've been asked whether I think it was possible, if Aristotle had not, I've been asked this question, if Plato had not been Aristotle's teacher for 20 years, would Aristotle have been able to reach the objectivist as against the intrinsicist theory of concept formation? I don't think so. I mean, you can't dogmatize on this. But as far as I understand, he was making his discoveries at a time when a genius was necessary just to grasp that we should look out at reality and deliberately, methodically adhere to it. That we shouldn't be occupied with what's going on inside our minds, but should focus completely on what's out there. Now, given that that is the orientation and the emphasis, that was his big discovery, I don't see how it would be possible at the same time for anyone to discover that the way his own consciousness is built contributes a major element to the process. I think that would have been hopelessly confusing. If you'd called Aristotle up on the day he grasped objectivity and said, you know, you didn't get it quite right because we don't perceive reality, quote, the way it is, only through our consciousness, he would have thrown his hands up in the air. I think that his idea that only reality counts had to be reached first. And it remains true. It's not as though Ayn Rand has overthrown Aristotle. And only much later, after a huge accumulation of scientific knowledge establishes that we can know reality and how we know reality. And by the way, we also grasp that mathematics is ubiquitous in knowledge and not merely an isolated realm as the Greeks thought. Only after all this, I think, would it be possible for someone to go on and discover that it's simultaneously true that only reality counts, and yet consciousness does contribute, so that in a way, knowledge is only human. I put that in again because it is completely wrong to make comparisons, as I've heard ignorant people do, how much better Ayn Rand is than Aristotle and how many mistakes Aristotle made. If you could not say that in her presence, I guarantee you, because she would condemn it as utterly unhistorical, unjust, ungrateful, to not to even go into other terms. So try to appreciate the historical context in which Aristotle functioned. It's basically like trying to say, this guy that invented the wheel, what good is that? He couldn't have invented a Lexus, which has four wheels and makes such fantastic use of them. But the question is, where did the Lexus come from? Now, if you want a genus, I did not really use the genus method here, but if I tried to just summarize the whole thing, I would do it like this. Knowledge involves some kind of relation between consciousness and existence, would be the principle, the broadest principle. And then I would break that down into three subdivisions. The people who say yes, but it's entire, the only active or contributory element is consciousness. And that's a subjectivist. The people who say yes, but the only active or contributory element is existence, that's the intrinsicist. And then third is the people who say yes, but both elements are active and contributory, and it's the relationship that's key. And that is the objectivist viewpoint. I don't know if that helps, but that is a way of organizing. Now, the last point on this is integration. How would we integrate the idea and method of objectivity with some of our earlier topics? For example, with reason as man's means of survival. Well, what have we learned something now about reason that we didn't know before? Obviously, the basic nature of reason, and thus the unifying root from which all the different aspects of reason that we started with in lecture two. Remember, we just plunged in and said abstraction, science, words, numbers, etc., as starting points. We see now how they all tie back into the fundamental method of a conceptual consciousness. And they're just different angles, consequences, or aspects of it. We see now why reason works in production as opposed to just going by random feeling as an approach. Because the former, reason, is objective. It's tied to reality. Is there an integration between objectivity and egoism? Well, if objectivity is corresponding or conforming to reality by a certain method, is that to your interest? Obviously, the true egoist has to be objective. You know, as against the people who say you have to be disinterested. If you have an interest, that disqualifies you. If you have a concept of objectivity and egoism that are valid, one entails the other, and the other direction, because if you use objective methods, you got to end up with the only logical reality-based ethics, which is egoism. So either entails the other. How does objectivity tie in with the discussion of justice? Well, this is where we expand on the whole idea of what it means to judge another person. We can now say you not only judge the actions and character, but you have to be objective in judging. And that, of course, raises a big question. How can you be objective in making value judgments? How do you get objective values? And that's going to be a later topic in the course. Actually, I want to get through three more topics before, and we have three more lectures, so that's going to work out just well. I want to do force, the evil of physical force for next time. Then we'll do a topic on sex for the next time, and then we'll do the one on how objectivity applies to values for the last time. I think it's better if we leave epistemology for a while now because it's pretty wearing. So let me just give you the assignment and then go over some written questions, and we may have time to do a couple of live questions. All I want you to do is take the principle of the initiation of physical force is bad, is wrong, is evil, and validate it inductively. Reach it by induction. Now, this is the first time we're reaching a sin rather than a virtue, but I still want you to do it on the level of ethics, not of politics. You don't have to do anything about rights for this induction. Concentrate exclusively on the principle that it is wrong to initiate physical force against others, whether there is a government or there isn't a government, simply as a moral proposition. And try to figure out what things you would have to observe, what try to reduce back, what is the objectivist theory of what makes force evil, and what would be required to reach that, and what would be required to reach that, and then until you get to something that you can start with and then do it in stages. I don't think this is a hard induction at all. So I don't know whether I should give you any tips. I don't think so. I'm getting negative shakes from my advisors here. So I won't give any tips on that one. Let me take now some written questions on a whole bunch of different topics. And maybe in the last few minutes, if you take this time to formulate a question on any on objectivity or any part of the course, we'll try to get some in. And I got an interesting email from someone who makes a parallel between fiction writing and reading and reduction and induction. And this is from California. A student writes, "It may be useful for students to read examples of reduction performed by Ayn Rand in her preparatory notes for The Little Street and We the Living, which are in the journals." And then she gives the page number. She shows in The Little Street different pages between 23 and 47 that Ayn Rand starts with a very abstract statement of the theme and then breaks it down into less abstract statements. So she's reducing what would be required to get to this theme. And she breaks down the abstract statement into religion, morals, political systems, and family life. And then what would be required to come to conclusions in those areas. And then what kind of individual characters would lead to those conclusions, and what kind of concrete incidents would lead you to come to the conclusion that those characters, etc. So the whole, and the same thing for We the Living, the reduction from abstractions to concretes, that the inventive creative process is really, she started with her theme and went back step by step until she reached the kind of concrete characters and events. And then she presented those concretes, and we turned around and did the induction as we're reading them. We went back up the stages, implicitly, that she went down, and ended up, therefore, when Kira, or the other character, gave the statement at the end. What? Oh, yeah. We performed the induction going up those stages. So I think this is an excellent point. And can I give you credit in San Jose? I don't hear an answer, so I don't
know.
They're all muted. You'd have to press your unmute button.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, this is from Sally Driscoll in San Jose, California. And she writes, she concludes saying, the writer performs the complete cycle. I take it that means the reduction from the theme all the way down to concretes, and then the writing of the concretes until you reach, the reader performs only the final induction from the concretes of the story to its theme. And I think that's very apt. I want to give you credit. Amy has been telling me for some time that I should be studying the journals from the point of view of the role of reduction, but this was captured so nicely in this letter, this email from San Jose, that I wanted to read it to you, because although it's not cognitive, it's creative, but it's the same process of saying what would be required for this, for this, for this, for this, until you get to concretes, and then going up the chain. So it's just exact parallel to reduction and induction. Now I have a question from Australia, going way back to the lecture on egoism. I'm still trying to understand how I'm just rewording it here to take the essence that I have time for. I'm still trying to understand how your preliminary list of common sense values can be taken to be objectively valid. And then he asks, would it be true to say that an honest valuer would necessarily choose a list based on the perceptual or emotional pleasure he has experienced or observed? No, I would not put it that way, and therefore I'm not going to follow all of your inferences from there. Each of the values on your original common sense list has got to be based on your knowledge at the time. It is not the case that you start out as a hedonist. Now, as a baby, as a toddler, when you're simply reacting to stimuli, you're governed by pleasure or pain. But once you reach the conceptual level, your formulation would suggest that the way you get your earliest values is to judge everything by its pleasure, pain, effects, to do that as a conscious policy. If you did that, you would become a hedonist. And you would have no means in your early days of knowing what were the long-range pleasure, pain consequences. You couldn't predict. This was going to maximize my pleasure across the course of my life, therefore I value it. You are, what is this? It's not like anthropomorphism, but it's adultomorphism. You're putting an adult mentality into a child. For instance, if you tell him he's got to eat a certain kind of diet, you have to tell him it's on the grounds of your health, and that you will get sick, and you may have to go to the dentist, or you may, you give them various things. Now, ultimately, it's going to make him happier, it's going to make him stronger, but you don't say to a child, nor could he figure it out on his own, pleasure is the sole criterion, because he'd gorge on pastry. He wouldn't have the means to know. Or if you tell him money, and you should be honest with regard to money. Now, I ask you, would you be able to explain to a 4 or a 6 or an 8 year old, this is the way to maximize your pleasure in the long run? As against a bank robber is necessarily unhappy. You have no context to grasp that. The best way you could tell to a child would be, you wouldn't like it if somebody steals your property, right? And therefore you're being inconsistent. You don't even use the word inconsistent. He sees right away, yeah, I'm trying to make an exception of myself. And he grasps, there's something bad about this, because if somebody does it to me, I don't like it. Without being able yet to make any connection between consistency or of principled behavior and long-range enjoyment of life. That's what's wrong with hedonism. You cannot choose values by the standard of pleasure. You choose your earlier values completely unsystematically according to arguments that you can grasp within your level. It's inconsistent, this will make you stronger, which is self-evidently a value. You know, whatever the things are that you're able to grasp, and then you build within that. And only later, when you get to the level of induction that we were on, do you see, well, the common denominator is they either keep me alive or they help me enjoy the process. But you have to have those values first. So you do not do it by starting with the standard of what leads to pleasure. So you say, how can you take this list to be objectively valid? As a start, because you have some reason for each at the beginning. It's not objectively valid in the sense of it's now finally validated. It's a valid beginning. Now, here's a question on justice. He says, I want to understand whether I grasp what you said, that you don't use induction in the process of concept formation. What about the concept like justice? And then his answer is basically correct, but to put it in my own words, this is from Wisconsin. You have to use a lot of induction to reach the idea that I'm going to form such a concept as justice. You'd have to grasp by induction that human beings' actions have consequences. You'd have to grasp that your behavior in relation to them, in terms of reward, meeting out reward or punishment, has consequences, etc., etc. There'd be a great number of inductions. But at some point, you would reach the concept, you reach the idea. There is a certain form of response to others, which consists of judging and acting accordingly. And I'm going to make a category now for that called justice. But the act of making that category is not itself another induction. You needed those inductions to get to the point of grasping the category, of putting together such an idea as value judgment as applied to human beings, and a certain kind of action which consists of reward or punishment when I grasp that they have free will. You need a mass amount of knowledge, including inductive knowledge, to come to the idea I'm going to make a category and condense all that into one term, justice. But the idea of condensing it into one term is not a further induction. It's I'm now going to deal with all of that as one unit in describing people, describing behavior, or whatever. And now, then this same questioner goes on to say, in the lecture you got to the concept of justice, but not the principle. Would the principle be that engaging in such evaluations is important? Yeah, that's true. That really the principle of justice would be that justice is an essential of preserving your own value. But once you reach the concept, its evaluation is obvious from the context that made the concept necessary. Like when we finally reach objectivity, it's so obvious that I don't say, and on top of that, objectivity is crucial, you know, because what led us there was the need for guidance. But those, that was okay. Now, here's a question I do not entirely get. I'm afraid I'm not going to get to. If you really want a question asked, I urge you to send it in by email, because I'm giving people who actually sent them in priority. So by the time I get to oral questions, there is no time. But this questioner asks, in the discussion of justice, you use hypothetical instances. For instance, your discussion of good and bad children and good and bad schools. But is a hypothetical approach enough, or shouldn't we use actual instances we have observed, experienced, read about, or heard of? Now, I deny that the instance that I used is in any way hypothetical. If it was hypothetical, it was based entirely on either my own observations or observations I read about or heard of, which you contrast to hypothetical. I mean, I know about what happens in schools that don't give grades, and what happens when progressive parents treat their kids a certain way, etc. The most I've observed the consequences on the medical situation in HMOs, managed care, versus free enterprise medicine. So the only thing hypothetical was that I rearranged some observations into one example, but the elements were all facts that I either observed, read about, or heard of. A purely hypothetical, if I understand you, would not be acceptable, because it would be purely deductive. It would have to be something like, what do you think of catapulting a murderer to the moon as punishment? Would that be more or less effective than what we now have? Well, let me see. Man that travels at a certain speed and his organs and so on. Now, I mean, you could then debate forever, but this wouldn't prove anything. So it is not true that you should use hypotheticals. You should use what you have, but you don't have to have observed it yourself. That's the point of reading or taking classes. So you say, is there an age factor in the answer? Do we have to get old before we get our act together? And the only element of truth to that is you have to reach the point of accumulating a broad enough range of data, not by observation, but by reading and by learning about life. And beyond that, I would say you have to reach enough familiarity with the questions that have to be answered before you can appreciate the inductions. You know, if I just pile 10,000 observations on you and you have no idea even what you're trying to find out, you're not going to get anywhere. Now, Ayn Rand used to say, for what it's of value to you, that the first philosophical birthday is 40. And that until you turn 40, you have not yet had a philosophical birthday, in the sense that you don't have a wide enough range of data and of grasping questions and of integrating everything else that's already been learned, so you can start thinking on your own as a creative philosopher. But I don't think that's what you mean here. As far as an inducer, you certainly don't have to be 40. Now, I don't see that I can answer this question on the straight stick in water. Yeah. Briefly, and I don't think that's directly on the topic, so I'm going to have to pass that. Now, I just have about 60 seconds to say to this questioner who knows who he or she is, I can't go on a weekly back and forth on this topic. None of the examples that you gave, in my opinion, show that the Greeks or the early Americans were dishonest. You take as self-evident what was big news and had to be learned. So it's an issue of Columbus's egg, you know, where he said, can you stand an egg on its end? And everybody tried and they couldn't possibly. And then he said, it has to be hard-boiled. And once they grasped that, it became obvious. But truths that are self-evident to you in a certain stage of knowledge were very often inconceivable by people at an earlier time, and you must be very careful before you rush to say that they were dishonest, because any honest person could learn it from simple observation. That's as much as I can say on that topic, because it's right off the topic of induction. And, hey, don't we get 4 extra minutes, right? So if there's one person who wants to ask a live question, unmute your button. I want to count to three, and I'm going to take a name that I hear. 1, 2, 3. There isn't one. Did you unmute? 1, 2, 3. Okay. Everybody is satisfied. I covered the written and the oral, and I will speak to you next week, same time, same station. Thank you.